This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it's currently the 14th of September 2010 in Canada, where I'm joined on the line by Dan Fox, the editor of Urban Garden Magazine, which can be found at urbangardenmagazine.com. Mr. Fox, thank you so much for joining us today on the Corbett Report.
It's my pleasure, James.
Well, first, let's hear a little bit about yourself and the magazine. What is Urban Garden Magazine, and how did it get started, and how did you become the editor?
Well, I won't go for too long on my background personally, because it's not very interesting. I grew up in Britain, and I'm just a typical supermarket kid from the 70s, really. And I grew up in a typical housing estate in the Midlands, and I got up, I went to school, I came home, I ate my dinner. And I've never been involved in any sort of political activism, and didn't really start questioning where my food came from until I was in my early 30s. I mean, that said, I've always loved growing plants. I spent many hours in my parents' garden just staring at plants. Perhaps some people say I needed to get out more, but I think it's amazing, for instance, to think about how the vegetables we eat every day are the result of hundreds of years of breeding and selection. We humans use plants, and plants use us. They wouldn't be, many cultivars of modern vegetables wouldn't be alive if it weren't for human participation. So I think it's a beautiful relationship, and I've always had that passion. But Urban Garden Magazine kind of fell into my lap. I returned from traveling in India and Southeast Asia, and some of my friends were involved in hydroponics and wanted to start a magazine in Britain. Most of the magazines we get were from North America, and so they weren't really specific to our market, and they were spelling things incorrectly, etc. So, they knew I loved plants and loved writing, and the idea of trying to get a magazine off the ground was a lot more interesting than getting a job. But that quickly grew into having more political articles. We started talking about eugenics and monetary reform, and then we started getting more emails about the political stuff, which I hate calling it that, but that'll do, than we did about growing advice.
Interesting. So when did the magazine actually start?
The first issue in the UK started in March of 2007. And then I started taking it over to trade shows in the US. And they like the whole vibe of the magazine too. The hydroponics and indoor gardening industry is a really amazing industry. It's full of very progressive people who are open-minded, and it's due to their support through advertising and just general encouragement that the magazine's here. We touch on some emotive issues, and I'm sure that there would be some industries that would rather we just stuck to the main topic, as it were. So we started the North American magazine in September of 2008, and then just things went crazy, and it took off more in North America than it did in the UK, to be honest.
Well, that's excellent to hear, and it's interesting to hear that obviously the hydroponics and indoor growing industry is more progressive than other, I suppose, more urbane areas of gardening. And that is interesting to hear, because I'm sure, you know, from a general viewpoint of the general public, when they hear about hydroponics and indoor growing, they're probably thinking about a certain type of plant that people are growing indoors. So perhaps it's not surprising, but perhaps people's conceptions are a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go down the whole ludicrousness of, in a civilized society, we have certain plants that are legal and certain aren't. Any intelligent person can see that that's just ridiculous. But we're not, that's not really what we're about centrally. We love plants and we love food. It seems to me that we've become disconnected from our food. And this is a very, very worrying trait, especially when you consider that biotech companies are genetically engineering many of our staple crops. And through a Supreme Court decision in 1996, actually, they effectively own food. And companies like Monsanto have monopolized the seed market. And also usurp the very regulatory agencies that have been set up to control them, or to at least to oversee them. And we've all Googled Monsanto FDA revolving door, and if you haven't, I really suggest you do. And we can see that most of us have become completely reliant on a centralized industrial food system, which in turn is dependent on fossil fuels. So we wanted to bring out a magazine that really wasn't just filled with the stock imagery of office workers dirtying up their fingernails at the weekend, growing vegetables in the allotment. We realized that food production, and most importantly, local and community-based food production, was absolutely pivotal to any aspirations we may have to a free society and enjoying the civil liberties that we should. So I think food and politics couldn't be more intrinsically intertwined.
I agree completely with that assessment, and I think that that's something that people have for a long time neglected when they're thinking about their politics, but I think it is becoming more and more mainstream to be talking about this way. And certainly, we've seen in the last few years a meteoric rise in the amount of people with urban gardens or with some space in their urban setting where they're actually trying to grow food. And I think that's obviously related to economic factors, but perhaps also just a general growing awareness of the industrialization of our production of food and how that has really affected the quality of the food. But you mentioned, of course, talking about the U.S. Regulatory agencies and their ties with Monsanto, which, again, yes, I would wholeheartedly urge people to Google if they haven't already done so. But how about in England or in Canada? Is it basically the same regulatory structure for GM foods, or is it different?
Well, it's probably best that you talk in terms of Europe and North America, because Canada just seems to do whatever America tells it to do, to put it bluntly. With Europe, the whole political milieu was different. We have to go back to the late 90s when a genetic a scientist named Arpad Pudzai, and please don't ask me to spell that, I'll give it you after we talk. A scientist named Arpad Pudzai was devising scientific tests in England to... he was trying to work out how we could design tests to see if genetically engineered foods were safe to consume or not. And during these tests, he uncovered very, very worrying results. He actually was going in trying to defend genetically modified foods, and he actually came out with some very worrying results that showed that animals that had been given genetically modified food to eat had cell irregularities in their internal organs, they were smaller, they had damaged immune systems, they had problems giving birth or getting pregnant. And he released the findings of these studies, and there was a huge media outcry. He was gagged, actually, by the UK government for a number of weeks, but eventually that gag order was lifted, and he gave his story to hundreds of press in Europe, and literally hundreds of feet of column inches in British and European newspapers was devoted to exposing the alleged dangers of consuming genetically modified food. But in North America, it was a completely different story. Largely, these genetically modified crops were rushed through. Everyone saw dollar signs. Nowadays, you've got genetically modified ingredients in well over 70% of the processed food that you'll buy in a local grocery store in Canada or the US. And people are completely unaware, on the most part, of the problems with genetically modified food, and are just taking part unwittingly in one of the largest human feeding experiments that's ever taken place. In fact, the Japanese government, seeing as you're in Japan, is cited as saying that we're going to sit back and watch what happens to American teenagers before we make any decision on whether we're allowing genetically modified food in our diets.
Absolutely, yes. That's one of the things I think to love about Japan is that they are extremely picky about their food and seem to be very food safety conscious. So that certainly plays in our favor for things like fluoridation of the water or genetically modified foods. So that, yes.
Well, one key point that I omitted just there was that, and going back to the difference between North America and Europe, and this really gets on my nerves, so I apologize to your listeners if I start ranting, but the beautiful thing about Europe is that by law, genetically modified ingredients have to be labeled, i.e. the consumer has a choice. They can see, does this have genetically modified soy, for instance, in it, or doesn't it? And as a result of that being law, and obviously the media coverage that I just spoke about, the largest food producer in the UK, a company called Unilever, took the decision not to include genetically modified food, ingredients in its food, because it knew that it would have to label it, and it was worried that people wouldn't buy it. In North America, in the US and Canada, there's no such mandatory regulation for genetically modified ingredients to be included on labels. So the consumer is effectively blind. The only way consumers have to be sure that they're cutting genetically modified food from their diet is to look for the organic standard. If something is labeled organic, it can't have genetically modified ingredients. And just as a side note, the biotech industry lobbied really hard to get genetically modified food. This is food that's had genes from a completely different species forcibly inserted into it. And they tried to get this get it so that genetically modified food could be labeled as organic, giving us completely no choice. But fortunately, 250,000 signatures over a weekend stopped that right dead in its tracks. So, unfortunately, North America, the consumer is pretty much in the dark. And it was when I moved over to Canada a couple of years ago that I became increasingly aware of the problem. Are you still there?
Yes, absolutely. And
of course.
I think that is so telling, isn't it, that they don't even want people to know what they're eating. Obviously, that can only be because they're afraid of the consequences of that. And the relation between government regulation agencies and corporations are never so bald as when the corporations are lobbying to get labeling off of foods. So certainly that's one of the most jarring issues, and one that I think should at least get even the most gung-ho supporters of the corporate food industry to begin questioning their support of that industry. And another example of that was, I believe, in the States, there was a big backlash from the corporations when people tried to get bovine growth hormone milk labeled as such, and there was a big push to get that labeling illegal. But it seems now that BGH milk has actually been basically, for the most part, removed from the shelves because there was such a consumer backlash against it. We can only hope that something similar happens with genetically modified foods. But I guess that brings us back to your magazine, because earlier you mentioned that the advertisers would generally prefer that, you know, a magazine like yours would stick to the main issue, so to speak, and not talk about eugenics or the monetary system or false flag terrorism or the like. So certainly you must be up against some corporate pressure to do what you do in the magazine. So tell us about how you've come to cultivate your advertisers and your audience and the way that they react to these types of issues.
Well, first and foremost, you mentioned earlier about the kind of the stigma that people have when they hear the word hydroponics or indoor gardening, and they think it's for the cultivation of illicit crops. Now, hydroponics is an ancient technology and has amazing potential. And we're talking about a technology that can grow food using 80 to 90% less fresh water than conventional agriculture, and we've seen what we've done with climate change and the encroaching deserts and the decrease in arable land and how precious fresh water is becoming. we need to look to technologies such as hydroponics and bioponics, which is what really excites me. That's like an organic version of hydroponics. We need to look to these technologies in order to meet the food requirements of our increasing population. I mean, we've all heard of the population explosion, and 30,000 people are dying of starvation today. But it's important to point out that those people aren't starving because of a shortfall in production. They're starving because of poor distribution and politics and corruption. So I'm not saying that hydroponics is going to save the world or anything as exaggerated as that, but we certainly are looking to push hydroponic food production more into the mainstream. I see the hundreds of apartments that they've built in Vancouver and all these empty balconies, and I would so love to see them filled with, you know, opulent amounts of tomatoes and leafy greens and all sorts of veg. It's amazing what you can grow in such a small space using hydroponic technology. So we wanted to introduce a magazine that really promoted hydroponics, but also contextualized it in the urgency that I believe we need to address food production locally. I walk into a supermarket, and the last thing I hear are sighs of relief when I see shelves packed full of fresh produce. And I think I'd like to hear more sighs of relief, because most of us are so completely reliant on the supermarket that if the food was to be taken away, we would surely starve. I don't mean to be alarmist, but it's important to note that layered on top of this, we're completely reliant on a fiat currency debt-based dollar system, money that's not representative of anything of intrinsic value like, well, gold and silver it used to be, but money that a form of money that's totally reliant on, that's totally based on debt, controlled by private banks. And it's this money that's going around in debt circles and ever being devalued that we're all reliant on to survive. I mean, a visiting extraterrestrial might be forgiven for equating life on planet Earth with a system of normalized slavery. There you have it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And that's something that obviously I've turned to time and again in my podcast, in my work. And I have talked about the value of starting a garden or starting something indoors before to my listeners, because it certainly is not only a revolutionary act, but I would say sort of a necessary act in the current climate, especially the current economic climate. How could you afford not to have some sort of backup and to start building those communities that will be necessary at some point when we start to get ourselves off of the system that's been created for us? But unfortunately, I must admit that perhaps I'm not walking the walk. I am a bit of a hypocrite. I don't have any plants growing in my apartment. What would you say to someone who's right now starting from base zero with two black thumbs and no green thumbs and has never actually tried to do this before? What would you say to someone who's just starting out in this?
Well, if I can do it as a supermarket kid of the 70s, then I really believe that anybody can. Growing plants and saving seeds, and we've been doing this for millennia, and we're all living proof of that. The fact is that over the last 100 years, society has changed a great deal, and many people have moved from agricultural-based communities into urban-based communities, and as such, we've lost that connection. I mean, it's talked about very often. It's interesting to note that at school, I wasn't taught how to grow my own food. I was given careers advice. I took psychometric tests, and they said, "Dan, you should be a lorry driver or truck driver in America." Or I'm given advice on, I don't know, physics and maths and stuff that I rarely use in everyday life. But we're not really told very much about money issuance, and we're not told very much about growing our own food. So for someone just starting out, obviously subscribe to the magazine. I'm only kidding. there's so much information on the internet on growing your own food. start simple. Start with an easy crop. And like, for instance, lettuce is, I mean, you really have to try not to grow lettuce. Just grab yourself a small planter. You don't have to go hydroponics. Just buy some potting soil and grab some seeds and find a sunny window or buy a T5 high-output fluorescent grow light, which are very efficient. They use maybe 55 watts of energy. And here in BC, the growing season's really short. So I love my fluorescent grow lights just for starting off seedlings and getting them up to kind of teenage size before hardening them off and putting them outside and getting a head start on all my neighbors. It really is so much fun, and it really does connect you with back with nature. I hear these talks of people talking about the nature deficit syndrome. Much that I hate these created maladies, I do believe that many of us are suffering from something that could be described as that. Start easy, start small. It's wonderful to be a caretaker of a plant. And I think it's really part of our heritage, and it's a wonderfully therapeutic thing to do when you get in from work or whether you do other things with your daily life. So the main thing I can say is get your hands dirty. And if you want to try hydroponics, there are all sorts of amazing small systems that can help you grow 3 to 4 times the amount of produce in the same square footage. So space and, oh, I've only got a small apartment, these aren't excuses that we listen to. We're urban garden after all, so we believe everyone should grow.
Well, you did sort of jestingly suggest people subscribe to the magazine, but I would actually like to wholeheartedly suggest that, because having received a copy myself, I can say that it has an incredible amount of information and some very useful essays and things inside each issue. Why don't you run through a typical issue and what sorts of things people can expect to encounter in there?
Well, sure. And I'll send you over some PDFs as well, so you can take a look. But I mean, the issue I sent you, which was How to Become a Better Grower, I believe it was our Head Candy Summer Special. We do have some political stuff in there as well. We'll show people how to take cuttings from their favorite plants, how to grow using aeroponics. That's where you've just got plants growing in mist, like a nutrient mist. We'll talk about how to plan your garden, how to grow indoors and outdoors, how to work with your plants. How do you know if it's too humid or you're overwatering or you're underwatering? What effect does the pH of your soil or your nutrient solution have on your plants? And then we'll focus in on specific crops that people like to grow, like basil, tomatoes, and all the stuff that we love to fill our salad bowls. And then at the end, we're a no-holds-barred publication. We'll tackle the issues that other mainstream outlets are afraid to talk about. And we were one of the first magazines in North America to discuss peak oil. We'll talk about what's happening in Gaza. We'll talk about the propaganda from Fox News and the power of television. We were all born with televisions in our lounges, by the way. We don't realize how powerful it is to have this box with moving images accompanied with sound, pumping out opinions and ideas for most of the day. And of course, we published your amazing essay, False Flags Don't Fly, which is kind of how we got connected. People say, you know, Dan, why don't you stick to hydroponics? Why do you have to put in the political crap, as they politely put it? And I'm not a political activist. I don't have any drum to bang, but this is information that needs to be spread. It needs to be discussed. Food is intrinsically linked to many of the political issues that are going on in the world. And I'm concerned that, you know, for all the amazing power of the internet, I think it as much supports apathy as it does activism. You know, I'm sure any Facebook user has seen the groups that you can join. I bet I can find 1 million of us that think George Bush is a warmongering criminal. And I'm there thinking, only 1 million? And okay, let's say you reach your 1 million mark. What then? It seems we have to start with the basics. We have to take care of growing our own food within our communities. I'm not talking about us all becoming hippies, and not that that would be a bad thing, but you know, and all of us going back to the land. But we do have to take responsibility for our food. Otherwise, we're no better than metaphorical cattle at the trough of the industrial food system, just being fed and munching on whatever's put in front of us. And if we can continue sleepwalking down this road, then we're going to find, I think, historical precedent shows us that the privately controlled money system will be used to manipulate the masses, as it is already, and we will be signing up to get our subsidies, government-subsidized Big Macs and quarter-pounder burgers, because that's the only food that we can afford. And, you know, we only have to look back to the 70s to think of Henry Kissinger's famous quote, control food and you control the people, control oil, you control nations. I think he said it in the other way around, but it's a very, very telling. We can prate all we like about civil liberties, but unless we're taking responsibility and control of our food supply, we're like a baby complaining that its mother isn't using quilted Andrex to wipe its backside. First, we need to start looking after ourselves, and then we can take things from there.
Well, I think that's a message that will resonate strongly with many of my listeners. So if people are interested in finding out more about the magazine and potentially subscribing, tell them again about the best way they can find your magazine online.
Okay, well, as you said, the website is www.urbangardenmagazine.com. And I think if you go to /subscribe, you can go online there and subscribe using a quick form. We're also having an amazing get-together in Los Angeles on October the 2nd, that's Saturday, October 2nd. It's called Grow 2010, and the website for that is grow2010.com. And this is a show dedicated to indoor gardening, hydroponics, organics. We've got amazing guest speakers. We have Lawrence Brook, the founder of General Hydroponics. We've got Jeffrey M. Smith, the best-selling author of The GMO Cover-Up and, Seeds of Roulette and Genetic Roulette. He wrote an article for us called The GMO Cover-Up. He's doing a talk on the dangers of genetically modified food. We've got tons of exhibitors, workshops and presentations on how to set up an urban garden. So if people are interested in attending, they can, and there's a promo code GROWLA, all one word, and they can get their tickets for half price. There you go, there's a shameless plug there, James, but you strong-armed me into it.
Well, I would be there if I could, but I certainly hope people in the LA area or who can get it to that area on October 2nd will take that up, because it does sound like an interesting lineup. So genuinely, I do think that this is an extremely important type of magazine to be being produced right now, because it does concentrate on that area that I think a lot of other people might neglect in their political studies, which is of course the food and growing food. And I think that's just such an important part of our modern society, and I think it has to become more and more important as time goes by. So my hat's off to you for all the work that you're doing over there, and I certainly hope that that people will go and check out Urban Garden Magazine at urbangardenmagazine.com. So Dan Fox, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, James. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me on.